There are two new members of this church who were not able to be recognized and greeted by you on the Sunday we welcomed new members into the church. They are present this morning, Jeff Burke and Vicki Schott, and I would like them to stand and face you just for a moment so they can be recognized. And I ask you, please, when the service is over, to welcome them very warmly into this fellowship. Thank you both. This church will soon be 5 years old. In those years, every Sunday has been a celebration. Every sermon has been easy for me because of my happiness in this place. It is different this morning because of the loss you have read about in the bulletin. I speak for all of you and very sincerely for myself in saying that Frances Sloan will be missed for the multiple gifts she has brought to this church. We wish her the greatest possible happiness in her work and in her life. I must now speak a sermon which was chosen for a lighter and happier time. I shall need your help to make it come even close to what I had in mind for it. When Hamlet said to Horatio, "There are more things 'twixt heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy," he could just as well have said, "There are more things in the pages of the Bible, Horatio, than your casual reading has ever let you imagine." We're going to look this morning at one of those things Horatio might have missed. And we're going to do it for two reasons. First, because it is interesting, simply as a bizarre moment in history. And second, because it illustrates an old attitude toward women that made the women's liberation movement long overdue. Before we meet a woman who was queen for a day and whose name we probably did not bring with us out of Sunday school, I'd like to mention a poet who not only knew her name, but who used it to illustrate a point. Robert Frost has a poem called "Provide, Provide," in which he argues that too many fall from great and good for us to doubt the likelihood. It can happen. So either die early, he says, and avoid that fate, or else make careful provision for a good ending. Earn it with good works. Buy it, if necessary, with money. Do whatever it takes, but provide for the future. There is never a guarantee that you will stay at the top of the wheel of fortune. Reasonable advice, but I'm interested in the poem only because it starts out this way, about a once beautiful woman fallen from grace. The witch that came, the withered hag, to wash the steps with pail and rag, was once the beauty Abishag, the picture pride of Hollywood. The last line, of course, is playful. She had nothing to do with Hollywood, as we shall discover, but she did have a great deal in common with Marilyn Monroe, and she almost certainly was a victim of the fickle ways of this world. Here is the background for her story. The king of Israel, David, has been a great warrior, but the years have taken their toll, and one day when he is out fighting the Philistines, he gets so exhausted that he is almost caught and killed. His troops are appalled. They tell him, "We can't have this anymore. From now on, you stay at home. If you were to die, the lamp of Israel would go out." Apparently, this impresses him. They make it stick, because right after that, we read this unique and puzzling little story. Now, King David was old, advanced in years, and they covered him with clothes, but he got no heat. It seems at first glance to be a simple matter of falling body temperature. But you wonder why David's having the shivers would be so important that the Bible writer takes time to tell us. Already there seems to be more to this than meets the eye at first, and that impression deepens as we keep reading. You might expect, since David gets no heat from this experiment, that someone would suggest putting more wood on the fire. But instead of that, his servants say, "Let's go out and find for the king a young woman, and let her stand before the king and care for him and lie in his bosom, and the king will be warm." It is understandable that if all you're trying to do is raise body temperature, the presence of another human being in the bed might help. But David had 9 wives, some of whom were certainly still living, and he had a whole harem of concubines picked up along the way or sent as gifts from conquered kings. So why should it be necessary to go looking for someone else? The next verse may give us the clue. "So they went all over the land looking for a beautiful girl, and they found Abishag, the Shunammite, and brought her back to the king." What we have is the first winner of the first Miss Israel contest. And the inevitable question is, why did the person being brought to keep the old king warm have to be so extraordinarily beautiful? Why not a genial lady of considerable substance? So much warmth per pound? Because if the only purpose is to make the old warrior stop shaking, looks would not be really all that important. But they are important. So important that the king's men search through the whole nation to find a stunning beauty, prettier than anybody in the harem or the wife house, and they bring her back to the palace. As the Bible puts it, "And the girl was very beautiful and cared for the king and slept in his bed," but in the quaint language of the King James Version, "he gat no heat." The story has a certain reticence about it, so that some of my students each year, reading it in a hurry, see only that first the blankets failed, and then that a carefully chosen companion came and did what she could, but that failed too. End of story. Yet even with its reticence, the story is clearly hinting that Abishag was expected to do more than adjust the thermostat or hand out vitamin pills. But scholars disagree as to what that more was. Here is one of them who thinks he has the answer. He says this may have been the survival of a primitive ceremony of contactual magic. That's what a PhD in sociology says when he means touching. The survival of an ancient ritual for transferring the heat and health of a young body to an old one, a kind of osmosis, in other words. And it is true that people have believed in this kind of magic by physical contact. The Jewish historian Josephus points out that doctors sometimes prescribed it, and the famous old Greek physician Galen vouches for it as an occasional practice. By this theory, the touch of the Shunammite maiden will bring old King David back to life and vigor. Another scholar in a book on folklore in the Old Testament has a slightly different explanation, which requires another jawbreaker word to give it respectability. What is here involved, he says, is the principle known technically as osphresiology, a word which has to do with the sense of smell, the idea being that being close enough to breathe the breath of young and vital persons may be helpful in prolonging life. He points out that as late as the 18th century, there were people in England who believed this. And we read about one enterprising physician who actually took lodgings in a girls' boarding school for this very purpose, he tells us. His name was Philip Thickness. He lived in Bath, where so many people came for healing and health, and he wrote these interesting words. I am myself turned of 60, and in general, though I have lived in various climates and suffered severely both in body and mind, yet having always partaken of the breath of young women wherever their paths crossed mine, I feel none of the infirmities of men many years younger than myself. Now, I'm not entirely sure what to make of that, or why the breath of young men would not do just as well, but the good doctor obviously felt that he had found the fountain of youth. I must tell you now that I do not buy either of these explanations for the story of old King David and young Miss Israel. Each one of those explanations may be partly involved, but too much emphasis is placed in the story on her charms. She is not simply young. She is a ravishing beauty. It's not osphresiology or contactual magic or any other kind of mystery. It's something much more simple and basic. There is a world of evidence among field anthropologists that the authority of a king, even his continued life, depends on his virility. If he is potent, then the country itself, its people, and its crops will be fertile as well. If his potency becomes an issue, and he proves he can still father a child, he can go on being king. If not, his reign is over. I have a May 1977 National Geographic essay in my files, which I clipped to show to students when we read this story. It says that in ancient Ireland, when a monarch could sire no children, he was ritually killed. He is not useful anymore. Books of folklore are filled with stories of how a king's rule may depend upon his continued procreative processes. So what's really happening is that David has become impotent, and his counselors have tried desperately to rejuvenate him with no luck. They are his cabinet. If he goes out of office, so do they. So it isn't hard to imagine how their committee meeting went. The chairman calls for ideas. Reuben raises his hand. Shall we pile even more blankets on him? No, no, we've tried that. If we aren't careful, we'll smother him. Levi? Well, they say jogging is good. Levi, this man can't even walk. Uriah, what do you say? My uncle swears that the pits of pomegranates will work every time. Uriah, please, we've tried your pomegranate pits. Gentlemen, is this the best we can do? Benaiah, you haven't said anything. Do you have any ideas? Well, yes. As a matter of fact, why don't we have a beauty contest? Find a girl with long black hair framing an exquisite face, with an air of innocent wisdom about her, a voice soft and mellow, and bring her back to bring the king back to life. Everybody votes yes, and the chairman says, we'll have to draw straws. I mean, we can't all be on the search committee. So they found the girl, as we already know, and brought her back. And what isn't in the Bible, but ought to catch our attention, is that no one bothers to say a word about how she might feel. Maybe she didn't want to leave home. Maybe she already had a boyfriend. It wouldn't have mattered, would it, in that male-dominated world? They might have been kind enough to tempt her with bright lights and parties in the capital. But if that failed, they could always play their trump card. Abishag, your country needs you. You may be the last and only chance to save the throne for David. We wouldn't be here if it were not vital to national security. So ask not what your country can do for you. Ask rather what you can do for your country. I like something Frederick Buechner says about Abishag at this point, that her sad story makes it clear that in peace, as well as in war, there's no tragic folly you can't talk a nation's youth into simply by calling it patriotic duty. We don't know which argument did the trick, or whether she even had a choice. But they brought her to Jerusalem for the critical test, and David flunked. If you have any doubts left that this is an accurate reading of the story, the next verse should remove them. David has no sooner failed his final before one of his sons named Adonijah begins plotting to become the next king. The point is, though nobody says it, David is finished. So Adonijah gets a chariot and 50 men to run in front of it, and it's the Iowa caucus and Super Tuesday all rolled into one, but he loses. His half-brother Solomon wins the election. But Adonijah is not quite finished. He begs Solomon's mother to ask the new king for Abishag so that he can have her for himself. Now, it's possible that he could have fallen in love with her, but the request is more likely political. If he can have his father's last concubine, it will make him a more legitimate heir to the throne. He might still stir up a revolt and get rid of Solomon. Solomon, of course, saw through the trick instantly. May God strike me dead if I don't make this upstart pay with his life. And so, in the nice, quiet world of Old Testament politics, he put out a contract on his half-brother's life, and one of his agents quickly killed him. Abishag, we never again hear her name. Do you think it's possible that she might have talked things over with Adonijah, hoping a revolution would sweep the two of them into power? I hope so. Because if she was not part of a plot, then once again she was only another woman used by men as a pawn to further their own interests. And somehow I want her to have tried at the last to control her own destiny. I don't know what useful lessons may be hidden in this odd story, except that given our sometimes excessive pride, this might be worth remembering. In the long shadows cast by time, our little victories are really rather modest. Queen for a day. And if that is not a profound truth, maybe we don't always have to have one. Maybe it's enough just to remember someone whose name was immortalized briefly in the Bible and then forgotten. The name of a girl who, in Robert Frost's poignant words, was once the beauty Abishag. So I salute her, this lovely, distant cousin of ours, for whom beauty may not have been enough.